Well, my name's Sandra Menarcolic.
Hey, Sandra.
Well, I'm walking big these days. I don't know about the book part. It's always a privilege to be able to do something within 4AA. And when I came in, and one of the first things that I was told was, when AA asks, say yes. And I don't hear that enough, but if AA asks you to do something, say yes. And I've seen people say no, and I don't want to belabor that, but it works to say yes. And so, and everything doesn't feel great all the time, but I can do this, and I'm very grateful that she asked me to do this. So, my story starts. I was born into an Army hospital in World War II in a little place called Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the only industry was a big secret. It was the Manhattan Project, and the atomic bomb was being put together there. And so when I was born, my mother said it was the most exciting time ever. There were 100,000 people that were brought in, and it was all closed behind gates, and they would smuggle liquor in my baby bottles. And it was dry. Tennessee was dry when I left Tennessee 41 years ago. It never got past. I think now you can have a drink, but when I lived there, if you had a drink, you had to take it in a brown bag to a restaurant. I think finally there were liquor stores, but when I was growing up, a teenager, there was no liquor sold in town. The bootleggers somehow knew where it was, and they were usually the cabbies, and they had connections with the cabbies. But at any rate, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was the kind of alcoholic, he was a binge-drinking alcoholic. And my earliest memories are of my mother standing, screaming, pouring liquor down the sink, and threatening to leave him, actually leaving him, and then later telling me, well, you cried for him so much we went back. And anyway, so I grew up thinking that I was the one in charge of these two people. And when I got sober and my dad got a big book and he read it and he said, well, now I know I probably have that problem, but I don't think you do. But he said, I know who really had that problem. It's your mother, even though she never drank. And she's still with us. There are advantages to never drinking. You just get to live a long, long time and be miserable. But and I have to say this. I'll just fast forward to this. One of the reasons I've stayed active in AA for as long as I have, I watched my dad at the end of his life. And I have to say, too, he was an alcoholic, but I've learned I love alcoholics. I mean, we're great people. And he was a binge drinker, so he never drank like I did. He would go weeks, months, and not drink. And then he couldn't stand it anymore, and he'd drink, and bad things happened. But the last 5 years, he had this aortic aneurysm, and he was just a big moose. He was in surgery on an Easter Sunday, 1987, for 8 hours. And we all came together and sat there, and he was going to die. And 5 days later, he came out of a coma, and he lived another 5 years. And because of the 5 days of coma, I've decided he would detox in that time, because the doctor said to him, if you ever take another drink, you're a dead man. So he didn't. But I watched him in those 5 years, and his health got better. He quit wrecking cars like he had, and he was not the menace that he was drinking, but he had given up the one thing that made his life bearable. Because if you are a true alcoholic, alcohol works to make it better. And buddy, I'll tell you, it worked for me. And when I gave it up, something had to come in and replace it. And so, anyway, that's been a prime motivator for me to stay with this blessed program. And anyway, my own story is that we grew up in this little town in this little house, and he did great or he did horribly, and we all danced around his alcoholism. And I was the oldest child of four, and when he would I remember driving to the Eagles Club, and Mother would send my little brothers. I mean, these two little boys would go in and bring him out, and here he'd come. And he was the kind of drunk. He staggered, he slurred, he threw up, he peed on the floor. I mean, he was awful. I, as the oldest child, was the one who could handle him. So So I would get him in bed, and I would somehow get him off the horn of the car out in the driveway, and we never told a soul that this was going on in our house. And I hated alcohol. And I didn't drink. Well, it was hard to in a dry town where, and this was the 60s, the 50s and 60s. So the boys would go out and have beer, but nice, sweet girls wore Peter Pan collars, kept their legs crossed, and did not drink. So I was one of those. And but I got to college on a scholarship. I had lots of angels in my life long before I knew that I had angels in my life. And a guidance counselor said, "You are going to college," when I said, "There's no money." Because I also grew up with just no money at all. I mean, we never had anything. And but my mother was highly resourceful. She'd take my father's suits apart and make me an outfit. Mm-hmm. Or she'd go to the fire sale store and buy fabric and wash it and block it. And I'd pick out a pattern and she'd make something. And so we kept the secret, so we thought. And I got this scholarship, this wonderful scholarship to this wonderful school. And I even got to be a cheerleader there and got to do things. And I never understood why I had such a great college. I did not drink in college because I hated it. I mean, it was all too fresh. And it was really fresh because they packed up and followed me where I went to college. And mm-hmm. they were there. And, you know, this is the first time I've told this in a public place, but, and I promised my beloved sponsor I had for so long, and who said to me about some of these stories I have, "Can you not tell that again?" She said, "Don't you know that forgiveness is never bringing it up again? So if you're not telling it, maybe it'll go away." But this one night, my senior year in college, I was nominated for homecoming queen. And I went home in the afternoon. I'd had my job. I went home in the afternoon, and I was going to get ready, and my dad was drunk. And I was begging him not to go, but he was a daddy. And all those years I did cheerleading, I'd look up, and he'd be there. And usually he wasn't drunk. I mean, he didn't have to get drunk every day. And he'd be standing there. And I mean, that he was a daddy. And I loved him, and I hated him all at once. And that's what alcoholism is. And so I begged him, "Please don't go tonight. Please don't go tonight." And, of course, he had to go. And he, of course, fell over people and threw up in the stands and all that while I'm riding around with roses in a car. But, hey. Anyway, to make this short story longer, lived through that. But the embarrassment, I was always taught that embarrassment was like the worst thing in the whole world. Well, I met this guy, I was getting ready to graduate, and I'm telling you, I was that era when little girls could be teachers, secretaries, or nurses. They did not support themselves. These were jobs they had while their husbands worked, before they had their children. And I was looking for a man big time, and I found one. He drank a lot, he was crazier than a loon, he's my man. Didn't know him from Adam's house cat, met him in August, married him in January. And then went, "Oh my gosh, what have I done? Oh my God." And so we start a life together. And I did finish school. I went to work as a school teacher. I can remember cleaning up after him. And it, you know, the thing about dysfunction, I figured this out too about adult children of alcoholics, you may hate it, but it's what, it feels natural. It feels natural to be in chaos. It feels natural to be in just craziness and everything depending on somebody insane, their behavior. And that's how my early marriage was and my life was. So after I had been married, I got married in January, and in August we went to Florida. We came to Florida to visit his mother. And we went out, and I proceeded to have 9 drinks. I had, and I remember it because he counted. I had Scotch Stingers, I had Planters Punches, and I had alcohol poisoning. This is the first time I drank. Now, tell me that this is not a normal thing for somebody to do. I've never had anything to drink. I was so deathly, deathly sick. And so that was a gift, another one of my gifts, because the next 5 years I had babies. I had 3 babies, and I did not drink until I finished having those babies, and I'm grateful for that. But the day my last baby was born, my husband came to that hospital, because by that time I had decided to be cool, and I'd seen somebody who was so cool, who was standing there with a cigarette and this big glass of wine, and he brought this bottle of wine to the hospital when I had my last baby. And from that day until the day I walked into AA, I drank every day. I am a person of excess. I don't do anything in moderation. It doesn't feel good to me to do anything just sort of a little bit. So I started off drinking. I loved it. It made me great. It made me everything I was not. And I had the words of my mother in my head, if he would just drink like nice people. So I decided I was drinking like nice people. And that meant I started at 4 in the afternoon, and I drank in my kitchen. Now, I had my standards. We would not eat till after dinner. Or I wouldn't drink after dinner, but we didn't have dinner till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I would hear all these things about how awful that was. I was raising these kids, not feed them till so late, but they managed. And, of course, today they do the same thing. And that's the thing about those of you with small children. You might as well keep your mouth shut, because I think deaf mutes probably make the best parents. They don't do what you say. They do what they see. They learn what they live. And so we had this great life. And he's drinking and functioning, and I'm drinking. And the big thing that was hard for me was to tell myself that I really had a problem with alcohol, because I was... I finally decided it's like a person who has cancer and they catch it before they get all the way to death's door. I didn't have to drink early in the morning, but I would drink early in the morning. I didn't have to. I did have to drink every day, and I never had just one. And I thought it was just this incredible thing that I could hold all this alcohol and that I could drink and drink and drink and drink with the big guys, and I could keep drinking. And I just kind of knew. I learned early on that I better not smoke that funny stuff and that good stuff, because when I mixed them together, then I had these blackouts and I had little children. And I said things like, who took the babysitter home? And then one day I remember waking up at 3 a.m. in somebody's yard down the street, and I felt like I was wrapped in saran wrap. And after that, I thought, you know, maybe I better give up the other stuff. But nice people drink vodka, they drink gin, they don't care what they drink if they can't get what they want. So that also was my story. And raised these kids to be students. I was a student, their daddy was a student, and then our beginning. And some people can do that. They can meet, fall in love, and they get married, and it's happily ever after. But I married somebody I didn't know, and when I did get to know him, I couldn't stand him. So I just sort of made my own life. And the drinking, for us, held it together. So it was a long way into it. And our children, when they got to be teenagers, it started to crack big time. Because, as I said, that's what they grew up in. And my daughter, my middle child, who's my only daughter, really went completely nuts in high school. And so I took her to child psychiatrists. I put her in treatment centers. I did this. Do you hear it? I did this, and I did this. And finally, I heard one of the young doctors say to me, Mother, look at yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, I smoked 3 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day. And I drank myself to sleep every day, and I took all the pills I could find. And what was wrong with that? That was how I lived my life. But nothing worked with my child, I did have to look at myself. So I decided in that Christmas of 1987, I know what it is. It's the cigarettes I smoke. That's the problem. So in February of 19, and this is a big part of my story, through the grace of God, and I did not realize it because I tried before to quit and I couldn't do it, but I got a book that had a sort of a process with quitting, to set a day, to find people who had quit successfully and get them to agree to talk to me. I mean, it was the program. You ask for divine intervention, and all these things were in this book. So I did this with cigarettes. I was a raving lunatic. I quit smoking in February. It was the first, or the day before the first day of Lent. I was also very much a Christian. I taught Sunday school. And I can remember that last year of my drinking, I was teaching the seniors at this Episcopal church where we went. And it was the book of Job. And there were times when I thought, I am Job. What am I doing here? But anyway, I gave up the cigarettes. And I had DTs from that. I had smoked for so long and so much that I can remember my teeth chattering and in the bathtub and drinking straight from a bottle to be able to get through it. And so what happened in that next 2 months, I started drinking in the morning, and I started drinking pretty much all day. And it's a blur. I don't remember, but I wasn't smoking, and I was hanging on like this because I knew I just didn't want to go back to the smoking, because I'd also started, if you smoke as much as I did, and the only reason I know how much, because this is also one of my things, I kept a drawer that I would pour these cartons of cigarettes into. And so every three to four days, I was buying another carton of cigarettes. And I can't believe I smoked that much, but I did. That last night, I know that I had a pack from 5 o'clock till 10 o'clock. And then I couldn't breathe. But at any rate, didn't want to smoke anymore. Hanging on by my toenails. My daughter is absolutely swinging from the trees. And I wake up this morning in April, and I'm so hungover, I can barely get my head up. And you know that I can't sit up in bed. Everybody was gone. My kids were gone. I mean, I have children. They're teenagers now, but they still need mother. I sat up in bed, and I turned my head, and I smelled that. I got that whiff of, it was cool, the windows were open. I smelled that alcoholic breath that I remembered as a child going into my parents' room. And I went, oh, God, it's me. It's me. And I said, oh, God, help me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a scintilla of faith. Mm-hmm. As much Baptist churches I'd had, Episcopal churches I'd had, all the church in the world, knowing, seeing people across the room thinking, they know something I don't know. But I never could find it. I never could get there. God, help me. And I went to the newspaper, and I'm shaking, and I have my coffee, and I'm trying to focus on the paper, and there's this ad in the corner for adult children of alcoholics. And I went, that's it. It's Daddy's fault. I know. It, adult children of alcoholics is the center, and they're going to have a lecture. And it's that night. This lecture's on this night. And so I called, and I went down there, and I sat with all these people, and talk about something divine happening. That was not supposed to be in the paper for another week. The center had to get together really fast to get this thing put together because it was really scheduled for the next week. But I heard these words that it was all true. I mean, when you hear truth, and I probably was loaded that night when I got there. I'm sure I was. And anyway, but I called the next day, and I said, do you have counselors down there or individual people? And she said, oh, yes, and come right in now. So I drive myself down there, and how much do you drink? And I said, well, that's a very rude question. Why would you ask me that? And she said, I just need to know, how much do you drink? And it was the first time ever, because a couple of years before, I'd had all these abdominal problems. I'd had this horrible dysentery. Just imagine that. Couldn't hold any food down, but it was all that awful food, so I started eating like after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I didn't really start eating. I smoked and drank coffee until I started drinking. Then I'd have peanuts, and then I'd eat a huge dinner, and then the next day I'd be sick of the dog, and it was a great life. So I said, I don't know how much I drank. And she said, you don't know? And I said, no, because we have a closet where we keep wine, and I go and get another bottle, or sometimes I have vodka, and sometimes I have bourbon. Sometimes I'm a southern girl. I like bourbon still. She said, well, I think you need to quit drinking and go to AA. And I went, are you nuts? you don't know who you're talking to here. I drink like other people. And she said, well, you can't come back here then. And I went, what? And I'd never been disinvited, I didn't think. I couldn't stand that. And I hate those people to this day. Why? I just don't want to go back there. And and go through all that. But she said, well, you just can't come back here if you don't quit drinking and go to AA. And I walked out of her office, and there was another woman, young, 10 years younger than I am, young girl, coming out of another office with this that look on her face. And she said, they just told me I have to go to AA. And I said, they told me that too. She and I still hug and kiss. She goes to Central, and when I go down there, we got sober on the same day. So you talk, it's a miracle. We're evil twins separated at birth. And so the next day, she and I met at this ridiculous AA meeting where all these old men were going to be sitting around talking about booze. And I decided before I went, I was going to show those people. I just wouldn't have my drinks before I went. And it was so hard to go through that day. But I went, not drinking. And I got there, and it was in a church. And the lights were on, and people laughed. And people were clean. And people said to me, come back. And it had been a long time since anybody told me to come back anywhere, pleasant as I was. And so I got, and this wonderful guy, and it's scary, he's gone now, but he reminded me a lot of Jim, Bill Oakley. He had white hair and a white beard, and he walked out with me, and he said, chewing on a matchstick, and he said, sure, you need to buy one of those books. And come over here, Mary. And this woman with a cane comes over and said, do you have, where's your book? And she said, it's in my trunk. And it was $4. So I said, okay, I'll buy the book. And then there's a schedule in the book. And you show up tomorrow. And you show up every day for at least 90 days. And I didn't even, that was so ludicrous, I didn't even respond to that. Give me a break. I have responsibility. Of course, where, I don't know. What, I don't know. But I went the next day, and I went out to the greenhouse when it was on Morse. And then I went the next day, and then it was, every time I'd go, though, they'd all be smoking. And I thought, well, God, I'm going to smoke again. That'll be fun. I'll just start that up. And then somebody said, oh, you quit smoking? Well, there's a non-smoking room in the back room, non-smoking meeting in the back room. So I went back. And then I got all the support for not smoking. And for sure, for real, that year, I quit smoking, then I quit drinking. And I was so terrified that I'd start smoking that I didn't drink. I was so terrified that I would drink, I didn't start smoking. So that's where two negatives did make a positive. And it somehow worked for me. I went day after day because it was the only place I had any peace at all. And I would go to the 5:30 meeting because I really was an afternoon drinker. My oldest son was at Florida State. My daughter was a senior in high school, and she just knew. Mom's just gone off the deep end. And their dad said that too, and that was funny. He would sneak out behind the air conditioner and drink, and I'd find beer cans outside. And it got to be so little fun for him doing that, that after a few months, he quit drinking and started coming to me. And so that was a blessing. But it was not all fun and games. And I was still going to this hideous, horrible chamber with this counselor and being just beaten literally to death. But let me tell you what I know today. That saved my life. And nothing else could have done it. I couldn't hear. I couldn't see. I went there every week. I went to AA every day. They had these weekends. I did 3 or 4 of those where they'd do all this. It was back in the heyday of come to AA and we did guided meditations and all this goofy stuff, and I was supposed to stand in the mirror and say how wonderful I thought I was. And I closed my eyes when I did it because I couldn't stand to look at myself. And my little babies, I asked my son, who was 13 that year, I said, Alex, what'd you eat, son? Because I didn't go near the kitchen because that's where it started every day. He said, Mom, I had hot dogs and peanut butter, but it was worth it. It was worth it. And so in December of that first year, I was ready to check out. And I will tell you, I don't often say this, but, or I do too, I tell the truth more than not these days. I'd never had a suicidal thought until I got sober. for some reason, all the things that I did in my life to hold myself together, the outside things, that was not an option. But when I had the rug pulled out from under me with no smoking, no drinking, no funny pills, no ordinary pills, and no funny this, I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to be. And so in 7 months of that, this counselor saved my life one more time. She put me, suggested strongly, and my husband took me and put me in a treatment center over in Clearwater, and I stayed 28 days. Mm-hmm. And this is also how it works. There's a grand design and a plan. And I've decided a long time ago when I sat in the chairs and I came to believe my God is like a weaver, and he sees the whole thing. I am one thread in this tapestry, and I don't see. But I know when I look back on my life that it all happened exactly like it was supposed to. I was so thick-headed and so arrogant and so full of myself. If I had tried to do what most people, normal alcoholic recovery people do, go to treatment first, I wouldn't have heard anything. And I would have been one of those to go to 15 treatment centers. I went the one time I did here. And I got to, it was in Clearwater, and they told us, they took us on the bus to AA every single day. Blessedly, it was an AA. I get so upset watching television. There's a man who comes on, and he's selling some kind of recovery book. You can get sober. You don't need 12 steps. You don't need... And I'm thinking, wonder how many people you killed today, buddy. Mm-hmm. But my beloved treatment center, it was an osteopathic hospital, and they believed in the concept of the program. That, you know what, you can fool one person. So there was no individual anything. There was no individual counseling. It was all done by group. You were in this group, that group, big group, but always more than one. Because one-on-one, I can fool you, but I'm not going to fool everybody in this room. Somebody's going to hear my truth, and somebody's going to call me on it. And so that was part of the process. When I got out, I also got in touch with that thing that I had suppressed too for so long, which was my anger. When I drank, I shut down feelings, and I lived in my head. And I didn't let myself get mad, because you shouldn't do that, and I didn't get this, and I didn't get that. And it was all just, it was a game, and it was a show. When I came out of that treatment center, I was mad. I was mad at a lot. And through this beloved program and these steps, I've been able to deal with that too. And I've also been able to realize that there's a place in the big book where it says we can't afford, it's a dubious luxury we can't afford. And I think it's the improper, the kind of anger I used to have, you can't afford. But I don't deny it today. When I'm angry, I better look at it. And I cherish my feelings, because they are the place. They're like, my God lives in here. You know, when asked that question, where's the kingdom of God? Jesus said, it's in you. And I believe that. It's in here. We've got all the answers. But it's finding them and hearing them. And when I was drinking, everything was fuzzy. When I got sober and I'm present, I'm fully present. And I said that at one point in that first year. I know why I drank. I feel more than most people. I was like a raw nerve. But it was good. And I learned how to put those in perspective too. I've been blessed beyond belief with the things and the foundation that I had. That I did the 90 and 90, which I did. I probably went to a meeting a day for 2 years or 3 years. I don't know. And to this day, I can still go to a meeting. I have meetings. This is AA heaven. I'm considering leaving here right now. I'm thinking about it. And it, you know the thing that I will hate leaving? Here, my program. But I also know it's everywhere. And that I just have to go out and find it. And I will. But I can't imagine leaving this. This has given me life. I have always had a sponsor. I mean, the first gal I asked was the one who wrote on a little piece of paper, call anytime, and her name was Star. And so I called her and I said, you know, I'm the new person, and would you be my sponsor? And she said, I have to check with my sponsor. She was a chronic relapser. She only had 7 months herself. And her sponsor said, well, she's crazier than you are, so maybe you can help her. Go ahead. She was great. She was great. She had me writing. She had me this and then that. And then she left town. And then I had the series of sponsors who fired me. And they would go, oh, please, don't call me again. And, you know, I can't do that. And so I had four or five of those. And then this woman I really thought well of, and I didn't want her to be my sponsor because I didn't want her to know about me. And but I did ask her, and she sponsored me for 10 years. And she taught me about, and I did the steps. I did the steps, of course, the treatment center way, and then I did the steps where I wrote my story the first time because I could get it. I will tell you that first year, my head was so messed up. I couldn't read a comic strip and tell you what I'd read. So I would read and try to figure it out, and that was my problem. I was always trying to figure it out. So finally this woman said, just write your story. What happened to you? So the first time I did a fifth step, I really told all my secrets, that the things that I thought the world would fall off its axis if somebody else knew. And that was very freeing, but that was not the end of it. And then when I got to the sponsor I had for 10 years, she said, I want you to sit down and write your fears and your resentments. Just write about your fears and your resentments, and let's talk about it. And she said, quit worrying about doing it perfect. Quit worrying about your charts. Because I'd go to seminars, and I'd get this book and that book. Craziness. You know, perfectionism is a flaw. It's a serious, serious flaw, because it leads to procrastination and then to paralysis. And I suffered a lot from that. But through these beloved, blessed people. And so she said, you know, these steps aren't an event. They're the way we live. They're the way you live your life from here on out. You got to know you've got a problem. That's the first step. You can't do anything about anything if you don't know there's a problem. And then you believe there's a solution. And I remember the day I was sitting. The sun was coming through the window. I was sitting in a meeting hearing a guy who had half his face gone from cancer sharing. And I came to believe my second step. I knew as well as I was sitting there was no accident, that I was there because I was supposed to be there. I was hearing exactly what I was supposed to hear, and that all I had to do was just keep the... And this is what she told me too. You just got to show up. If you'll just show up. And you know, sometimes that's still the hardest thing. I want to go off by myself. I want to take my wounds and my misery and my suffering and go behind a wall somewhere and just sit with it. That works. No, not. And so this is a place that's easy to show up. And so what else did I do? This sponsor I loved so dearly and love to this day, has moved to California. And so then there was this other woman. I also have been blessed. I've never been without a sponsor. And for anybody in the room, and for some reason, I understand it's harder for the men than the women to break down and do the sponsor bit, but I think it works. And when my sponsor was moving to California, she also pretty much flipped out because she was a diagnosed schizophrenic, and I saw her two or three times go off her meds and what happened to her. But she had the most beautiful AA program I've ever seen. She was pure, and she was that person that we talk about and how it works, even with mental problems. If you have the capacity to be honest, you can get this. And boy, she saved my butt time and time again. But she got a little bit kooky there toward the end, to the point she had asked me to be her sponsor. And I said, I can't be your sponsor. You're my sponsor. And so, anyway, and she lived with me because her house burned down, and maybe she did it. Who knows? But anyway, to make this short story just a little bit longer, the first 2 weeks when I thought, oh, that AA is what, you know, I was going there, feeling better, hearing myself laugh, but I didn't want to be here. And I certainly wasn't going to do that gooby chip thing. And I certainly was not one of these people who's going to stand up and tell my personal stuff in front of people, because I was raised different from that. And then I called my friend who lived. I thought, well, I can tell my friend who lives in Cooperstown, New York, because who's she going to know and who's she going to tell? She said, oh, my goodness, I have a friend from nursing school who's in Winter Park who's been in AA for years. Let me give you her number. So I called this AA person, and I don't know her from Adam's House Cat, and we're going to meet at Baker Square. So I'm all but wearing a disguise for mustache and glasses because I'm meeting. I didn't want any of these AA people to be seen with me around town because I had friends who knew who I was. And so I go in there, and across the room I spot my neighbor across the street had a maiden aunt sister who had been a nun who used to babysit all the time with that passel of children over there. And here she looked like Aunt Bee from Mayberry. And I look over there and I see Aunt Elmer. And I go, oh my God, that AA idiot's in here. And so I'm starting to leave and I'm walking away. And she, here comes the AA person. I knew it was her because she had long fingernails and I just knew it was her. And so she says, come on now. And I said, well, there's somebody in there I know. And she said, I know, Eleanor. And but at that point, Eleanor's waving. And I said, oh, no, I can't be seen with you with Eleanor. She said, Eleanor's my sponsor. What? I couldn't believe it. And Aunt Eleanor, the nun, had been in AA for, at that point, about 15 years. And so today, of course, Eleanor's my sponsor. And this beloved, she's old, and she's, God, I'm old, so she's really old. And I go on Sundays after I come over here. She lives just right down the road, and I come over here, and then she doesn't like barbecue. I do. So I go to Bubba Lou's and buy myself a big barbecue sandwich and go down, and she eats her little veggies, and I eat my barbecue, and we talk on Sundays after the meeting here. And we talk two or three times in the week. Now she can't drive, thank God. Oh, she can't drive. So, you know, I help a little bit taking her around. And she left the convent because they had told her that she either had to choose milk or beer because the water wasn't good over in Puerto Rico where she was. So you know what she chose, plus all the communion wine she could steal. And funniest story in the world. But her health's not real good right now. And anyway, but I have to tell you, she knows everything there's to know about me. And there are things I've told her. I did not want to tell that woman this stuff. And she'll say, no, you're not doing that. And, okay. And mostly, though, she'll say, you know, you've got sober instincts now. You know, what do your instincts say? And she's just amazing. And it's this thing of having somebody I feel safe with. And that's what I've learned in here. There are people in here I feel safe with. And I don't think I ever felt safe in my life. And with all this said, I am so, I'm going to shut up in a second. I'm grateful because the fallout of all this has been my marriage didn't make it. We divorced. He was sober. I was sober. And that obnoxious counselor was right. It's the worst marriage she'd ever seen. He has remarried happily. I have remained unmarried happily, and today I have 7 grandchildren who I talked to a bunch of them today, and I can't tell you when they send me little jokes on the internet and they say things to their mothers like, Grammy will get it, don't worry about it. And they call me to come, they want me to come, and I don't know why you don't live in my town, and you know, that's what this is about. And that my children trust me. They trust me too much because they would have me babysit 24 hours a day if I would. And I'm not ready to do that yet either. But I have choices that I can make and not live in total terror of what I've done and what I've said. And it's just a better way to be. And it's all based in one thing. The only thing, and I heard this early, the only thing you have to do perfectly is on a daily basis you don't mess yourself up. You don't put something in your body that is going to mess you up. And you just show up, be present, and let it happen. And so this is a miraculous, beautiful way of life. And I've reconnected with yet another church. I've spread myself around in the world of Christianity. And my minister there said, you know, your real church is AA. Because they know I come here, and it is. It's where I found God, and I could not find it anywhere else. And so, thank you very much. Thank you.